This is the crisis point. Welcome to the Crisis Point podcast, where, like G.K. Chesterton, we discuss nothing except for politics and religion because, well, there's nothing else to discuss. I'm your host, Michael Warren Davis, the editor of Crisis Magazine, and I am joined by a special guest, Brandon McGintley, who is a writer, I'm sure well known to many of our listeners, and who has just come out with a fantastic new book. I think one of the best books I've honestly read in my life, and I would say, you know, probably the best book that I've read responding to the crisis in the church. It is called The Prodigal Church, and it's available now from Sophia Institute Press. It was just published in 2020, this year, and I'm very grateful to Brandon for coming on the show. So, Brandon, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Thank you for your kind introduction.
Oh, absolutely. Well deserved. So the book, again, it's excellent and it's far ranging and it's an extraordinary vision on how to renew the church and how to renew society through the church in a lot of ways. I want to ask Brandon about a couple of very particular comments that relate more to politics because this is an election season and we're more of a current events magazine. So I wanted to focus in on something that I think a lot of our listeners are going to find at least very interesting, possibly controversial, which is redeeming, in a sense, the idea, or the concept, but not the brand, so to speak, of the seamless garment. So I'm just going to read a little bit from the book, if you don't mind. So Brandon says, "Faint-heartedness in the culture war is not distinct from, but absolutely connected to, faint-heartedness in condemning other social and economic injustices." And he uses this really terrific expression. He talks about our deranged, rapacious, even pagan American order. And so that is what, that is what we cannot be faint-hearted in addressing. But that rapacious neo-pagan order extends, obviously, to the social sphere, the cultural sphere, but it also extends to the economic sphere. So I agree entirely, for what it's worth, that we need this more holistic approach to Catholic social teaching. But Brandon, could you explain very briefly what exactly you imagine that that new resourced seamless garment looking like in practice?
Sure. No, it's a good question. You know, I come to the idea, to the kind of acceptance of the concept of the seamless garment, if not the brand as popularized by, you know, Cardinal Bernardine. Because the brand, of course, the way it's come down to us is not an elevation of social or economic justice, but more comes down to us as a downgrading of abortion among the issues we're supposed to care about. Right. What I'd rather do is upgrade everything, not to the sense of equals, but the sense of remembering that these things, these teachings that you know, every moral teaching of the church is in some degree a social teaching. Every social teaching is in some degree a moral teaching, and these do all hold together in kind of a coherent whole. So I come to this idea precisely because, regarding the destruction and the corrosion of our culture of marriage and family, certainly in the aftermath, especially of the recent Supreme Court cases that, you know, took what had basically been the case in terms of the way most people thought about marriage and then codified it in law, I can't look at that and say, well, our problem is sequestered to the way we think about marriage and family. Clearly, there are other things going on here. You can't have the this complete destruction of a culture and the ideas surrounding marriage and family without there being other things that have gone wrong as well. And so that's how I get to see it. Okay, obviously we're thinking wrongly about other things too. And so I think we think wrongly about the way justice in terms of society and economy is meant to be. And so I so this idea then of the seamless garment in practice looks like a public policy and a way, ultimately, if we're getting to even bigger questions, way of organizing our public and political life generally that is organized first and foremost around the reality of the family, the reality of the church, the reality of man's social nature, the fact that, and the fact that we thrive as social and spiritual, as ecclesial beings, best when those institutions, when those realities are not just considered sideshows that we just make space for, but that are the central realities of social life itself. And so, you know, it in our particular moment, within the bounds of our politics right now, that means that I am more likely to embrace some ideas that come from the political left in terms of things like, government support for families, for poor families, for leave for mothers and fathers, things like that make that center the life of the family, that make the life of the family as possible, as feasible as possible for as many people as possible. And I think that a political society, a political order that recognizes the centrality of the family, the centrality of life itself, is one that would look radically different, look radically different from the one we have right now.
That's certainly true. And your thinking seems to be a lot more along the lines of a lot of, not to insult you, but a lot of the Christian democratic movements in Europe that never divorced social conservatism as such from the need to materially support, especially, you know, poor and working class families as well, through economic incentives, through economic protections, and this division of you know, social conservatism from what we might call like a fiscal conservatism, or the unity that we take for granted or did before 2016 between social conservatism and economic neoliberalism. Yes. That's pretty unique to America.
Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, the European example is well taken. You know, it's, I think that in reaction to a very strictly materialist hard left, and often not so hard left these days, strictly materialist, view of what motivates people to action and what makes life worthwhile, that I think is both left and right, but that, you know, that I think in reaction to the perceived threat of kind of a leftist materialist atheism, we can sometimes go too far in dismissing the material reality that material well-being, that a baseline, this, you know, taking this straight from the 20th century popes into pre-20th century popes and Leo XIII, a baseline of material well-being is essential to our spiritual well-being, to our well-being as complete persons. The Catholic faith, I talk about this in the book, I talk about this all the time, the Catholic faith, specifically in contradistinction with Protestantism, is very, very invested in corporeality, in the embodiedness of what it means to be a person. And so that doesn't mean that we sign on with everything that a social democratic movement might throw our way. It doesn't mean that we just abandon our reason and say that whatever they say goes. But recognizing that there is a material basis to our comprehensive well-being is important to participating in politics in a distinctly Christian way.
It's interesting that this is becoming more mainstream on the right, even as we speak, because, you know, Donald Trump, you know, whatever one thinks of Donald Trump, his economic agenda that really resonated with the Republican base was all about protecting, especially working class and rural families, and using the government to assist them. And, you know, this is a lot of people, I'm sure you're one of them, were kind of sitting back and thinking, why did it take so long for us to, yes, to get absolutely to this point?
Absolutely. And frankly, you know, placing to one side other concerns one might have about the president, this is one of the greatest signs of hope in our politics in a long time.
Yeah.
And also, I think, one of the greatest missed opportunities for this particular president, because I think more could have been done. I think Ross Douthat was just talking, maybe even just been on the day that we're recording this, about the missed opportunity to really needle his own extremely loyal, beholden to him Republican politicians in the Congress to make the kind of deals that would have made him could still potentially, depending on how things go over the next month or two, could still make him a much more transformative president than than I think he has been so far.
Yeah, I remember right out of the gate, he was calling up all those business leaders, and he was, 700 jobs in Pennsylvania, 2,000 jobs in Ohio. And then I was really excited because, I mean, I guess I'm kind of an old school protectionist. I'm a distributist.
Sure.
But, that I was really, really thrilled, and I'd voted for him just for this reason. And then it did kind of peter out a little bit.
But I think, even the fact that the White House, with some exceptions within the White House, has been, on generally speaking, the more generous side, not as far as I think they should have been, but on the more generous side, certainly in comparison to some other Republicans when it comes to coronavirus relief, has been just another example of, I think while I wish that more had been done and is being done, I think that there's a real sense in which we are better off in this particular respect in this crisis with this aspect of the American right having been elevated to the White House rather than a more strictly limited government version of the American right.
Yeah, this is, and again, I mean, I have a very good friend who just today was saying, I like Trump, but I really don't like, I'm really not happy with his fiscal policy right now. I said, what don't you like about it? He said, all that wasteful spending on coronavirus relief. And I was thinking to myself, oh, this guy's a really hardcore Trump supporter. Yeah. A great guy, very, very thoughtful, extremely well informed. Sure. But, a lot of the American right can, it seems like, and I could be wrong, it seems to me like, they will support the sort of the protectionist pro-American economic agenda. But a lot of their thinking, for better or for worse, but just as an observation, their thinking does still seem to be with the small governments, free market mentality. So is it possible that because, for whatever reason, that, the thinking is going to slingshot back and become and go back to sort of the Romneyite, business class Republicanism?
I don't think there's a market for it, frankly. I don't think, I could be wrong. I think that if Biden wins if Biden wins going away, which I would be surprised by, I wouldn't be shocked, but I'd be surprised by, I do think there could be a backlash within the party that says, oh, the problem is that we were not fiscally conservative enough. And I think that would be, as usual, precisely the wrong lesson.
Yeah, I was shocked when at the debate when Biden's been doing this Buy American shtick, right? Yeah. And which is great. I mean, you should buy American, but he's been doing it for a while. This is kind of his roots as a blue collar union guy, and that's fine. It's clear that he's only doing that now because it was so successful for Trump, and yet Trump didn't call him out. He didn't say, "Hey, Joe, you're stealing my line. That was my that was my plank in 2016."
Right.
And so it just, again, I'm just afraid that this is going to be a lost priority. But I don't know.
Yeah. Years ago, back in 2012, I guess it would have been 2012. Right? Yeah, because it was after Romney. I kind of mused that that the future of the GOP was going to be more in the upper Midwest and less in Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
And I turned out to be right. Not exactly in the way I was expecting.
No, but it's true though. Now, I'm sure that a lot of people called you a socialist for saying these things back in the day, as they did me. And it is just irritating to, to constantly have this debate and say, no, I'm not a socialist. I'm more right wing than you are in a lot of ways. But that's just the way that it is. But I mean, again, it's like the seamless garment thing. You know, we need the concept of a holistic, integral Christian Catholic politics in the broadest sense. But it's hard to articulate because there are so many people that just kind of shut that view out.
Right. Right. And we are, and you know, everyone has their own political context in which they think, and I certainly do. I don't mean to, don't mean to present myself as having transcended Americanism or something like that.
Sure, you know? Sure.
I don't come down, you know, from the skies to tell everyone what politics is actually and how Americans are all wrong. But it's, I think that it's important at the very least to try to recognize the extent to which, our views of what is possible are circumscribed by American history. And so, like you said at the very beginning, we end up with a view of conservatism in America that is conserving a liberal founding, or at the very least a Republican, small r Republican founding that developed into a liberal founding. And that creates an odd situation here where conservatism and classical liberalism become identified with one another, because to conserve means to conserve American tradition. And the argument then becomes American tradition becomes self-defeating because it's based on the thing that corrodes traditions.
Yeah, that's true. That was Deneen's thesis.
Absolutely.
Certainly hope that he's wrong, but it doesn't really look like he is. Now, speaking of, and I just want to push this a little bit further because, you know, I'm a huge fan of this new magazine that just launched that you work with called The Lamp. And I would strongly recommend that anyone who's listening to this go out and subscribe to it, because it is just like one of the most exciting publications in print right now, and it is in print, which is awesome. So the editor is a guy that I've been following for a very long time. A friend of yours, Matthew Walder, who I didn't meet him until a couple of years later. But when I was living in Australia, I was good friends with another writer who was living in Australia named Helen Andrews, who a lot of our listeners will also know. I think she's now at the American Conservative. And she said, we're just talking about journalism, and she said, you need to meet Matthew Walder. He is the best columnist of our age. And I was like, that's a really big boast. But you know what? I would actually agree. I think she was right. So Matthew Walder launches this project that was a long time coming. Brandon McGintley, another one of our great writers, one of the great writers of our generation, is involved. And J.D. Vance published his conversion story in, I think, the second issue of The Lamp. Or maybe it was the first. It was the first.
First.
So J.D. Vance kind of comes from that same pro-family, pro-rural, in the sense that he believes famously that that we need to help struggling American communities that are sort of on the margins, and not only the margins as in, you know, inner cities, but also like the forgotten middle Americans. And I, you know, it's probably just my fascination with political, you know, lexicology, but I see a movement building there among guys like you, young, conservative, in a sense, Catholic intellectuals, but trying to transcend these old categories of conservative and liberal and socialist and just try to speak as Catholics. And it reminds me a little bit of L. Brent Bazell's project Triumph, which was, I know a lot of people in your circles admire it critically, but you know, not uncritically, but he did the same thing. You know, are you left or right? I'm Catholic. Are you conservative or liberal? I'm Catholic. And that's very attractive. So do you see that kind of the building blocks for a bigger movement here?
I think so. I think that you know, like anything Catholic, I think that it will be fractious and it will be at times and I say that lovingly, you know. Yeah. You know, the thing with any sort of Catholic movement, this is both the charm and the challenge of Catholicism, is that precisely because of this whole seamless garment idea, the fact that we recognize that everything holds together, becomes very easy to feel that anybody who gets one thing wrong on our accounting of the situation is going to dismantle the entire project by getting it. And it becomes difficult for everybody, myself included, to discern what are the things that we can disagree about constructively, and what are the things that where disagreement really does threaten the kind of integrity of an entire project. But in any event, I think that the instability, the unsustainability of the current way of thinking and doing politics and economics is only going to become more clear. There's no breaks that I can see on this particular train that we're on towards the collapse, or at the very least the continuing degradation of secular liberalism. And so that creates all kinds of opportunities. And I think that it will become increasingly difficult for people to hold on to the old ways of doing things. Doesn't mean there's going to be one unified block that's going to come out of this for exactly the reason I just articulated. It's going to be fractious. There's going to be lots of different things, but I think it's exciting and dangerous, like anything like this is. I mean, anytime there's this kind of tumult that I think, like I said, is just going to get worse. And anytime there's this kind of emergence of new to us ways of thinking, there's going to be things that pop up that need to be put back down again. Yeah. but at the end of the day, I'm excited about the possibilities of, you know, people like Matthew and JD and other folks who are you know, writing for The Lamp, or who are doing other projects. I think it's an exciting time.
It certainly is, and it gives one hope. I mean, I think a lot of our readers, even those who aren't necessarily familiar with Matthew Walther, probably know J.D. Vance from Hillbilly Elegy. Probably should have mentioned that earlier. But that was it made him a superstar. But his thinking, I think, is not what everyone realized it was at first, because he seemed to be more of like the Kevin D. Williamson, they're economically unsustainable and morally indefensible and, you know, let them burn kind of mentality. Right, right. If he doesn't like it, to hell with Ed Burke. That's not him at all.
Right. Oh yeah. Yeah. And another name, and this is a very different kind of plane of media existence. And again, someone else I don't want to mention uncritically, but I think the fact that Tucker Carlson is one of the most watched one of the most watched commentators in our political media right now is notable. And I don't sign on to everything Tucker says, but whenever he comes out there and says things like, people in rural America have realized they've been sold a bill of goods by being told that if they just play by the rules, they will eventually be prosperous, and they haven't been, and the people who've been telling them that have themselves been getting rich on that advice in Washington, D.C. And that's why people turn to Donald Trump and say, at least this guy seems like he might use the power that he has by virtue of being the president of the United States, a quite powerful position, to help people like me. And that doesn't mean that all of these movements or all of these trends or all of these impulses are always 100% virtuous, but the recognition that there is power out there that can be used for people, that is a good thing. And I think, you know, the more of that, the better.
Yeah. I loved it when he called out was it the owner of Cabela's?
Yes.
Bass Pro Shop? He named names. He was naming the plutocrats that were destroying middle America for their own profit. And that's never happened before. Not since the yellow journalists. You know,
we need more stuff like that. And so much of the fear is, if I go after the business world, I'll look like a leftist, blah, 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 blah. You know, but there's that graph, and I don't know how legitimate it is. It certainly validates my prior, so I'm going to roll with it. The graph of where actual voters stand with regard to being socially conservative and socially liberal, and being fiscally or economically conservative and economically fiscally liberal, for lack of better terms. And everyone thinks that all the action is in this bottom right quadrant, which is the socially liberal, fiscally conservative. That's where you run it. You run it people like that at Ivy League colleges or whatever. There aren't very many of those people, actually.
No.
Most people, or the plurality, when you actually suss out what they think about politics, turn out to be more socially conservative and fiscally liberal. They understand in some intuitive sense that the government can help the economy, that there can be, not necessarily in every regulation or whatever, but there can be a fruitful relationship between state power and corporate power that is helpful to people. And at the same time that, I should rephrase that, not between state power and corporate power, but a relationship where the state's relationship with the economy, which there's always a relationship with the economy, is organized in such a way that it's better than if corporations were left to organize things as they see fit.
Sure.
And at the same time, recognize in some intuitive sense that society works best when certain traditional, for lack of a better term, moral and social values are respected. There is a market there, and tapping it is not easy because there's many, many, many powerful people who don't want that to happen. But
right. A couple of years ago, I think it was in 2016, Matthew Schmitz had a really interesting article called Purple Family Values. And I don't know if you remember it, but he talked about how, traditionally socially conservative, Midwestern, swing voters really resonated with Donald Trump because, Schmitz said, they know that he's been divorced and remarried a couple of times, but they don't really care about that because the thing that they really focus on is that he has this really great relationship with his children, and that his children are successful and they're well presented and they're clearly a very close family, and Schmitz was saying we have divorce is so endemic in our society that a lot of people really can't hold that against someone like Donald Trump, or they don't, sure, they see no desire to, but they really do care about strong parental child relationships. Mm-hmm. And so that would kind of explain why on a lot of social issues, they're kind of indifferent, agnostic, libertarian, but they're very pro-life because
they recognize
that sacred bond really, really strongly.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's very interesting. Yes.
Yeah. So that's, we might be talking about purple dog Republicans at some point. So I want to just ask one more question that I know I'm surprised is getting as much attention as it is, and pleasantly so, because I find it very interesting. And that's integralism.
Yeah.
And I don't call myself an integralist for any number of reasons, mostly because I think most integralists would say I'm not an integralist. So that's their club, and I'll let them decide whether or not they want to let me in. But labels aside, is there, the idea of having an integrally Catholic politics is obviously very attractive, and it's what, everyone strives for, whatever they call themselves. I mean, George Weigel, in theory, is striving for a kind of integral Catholic politics. Don't laugh. But that's fine. But George is a good guy. He's a really, really good guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What is the difference, would you say, between this idea of the seamless garment and integralism, and why aren't they two words for the same thing, do you think?
I think they can be. I mean, this is where you kind of get to a complete rebranding of the seamless garment. And taking it out of, and this may be, maybe this is precisely the key to understanding the seamless garment in a way that does not result in the downgrading of abortion and of a kind of capitulation to American-style left liberal politics. And it's precisely taking the idea of the seamless garment out of the context of liberalism. When you think of it purely in the term, and this kind of gets at what I was saying earlier when I was trying to articulate what would a kind of a genuine seamless garment look like right now. Yeah, you know, it could look like, you know, more family leave, and I think those are good things. You know, increasing the child tax credit, and I'm not a wonk. This all sounds reasonably good to me. It intuitively makes sense, but that's still thinking of it within the context, circumscribed by our own way of thinking about politics, which is one that is essentially secular, essentially individualist. Mm-hmm. A truly seamless garment, one that recognizes not only that all of the church's teachings with regard to society and politics hold together seamlessly, but also that her teachings with regard to religion as a virtue, that is the justice we owe to God, that her teachings about her own spiritual and temporal authority, which exist, all of these things hold together, to use the word again, seamlessly. There are very important and difficult questions about how you actually actualize this in the year of our Lord 2020 in the United States of America, a country that has been, for the vast majority of its history, hostile to Catholicism of every stripe, let alone a Catholicism that aspires to being the motive force and organizing principle of all of society.
Yeah.
But my view is that at the very least, even if we place to one side the question of how do you create an integral Catholic society right now, thinking about that, understanding the integration of the spiritual and the temporal, the elevation of the spiritual over the temporal, the subsidiarity, to use that word, the submission of the temporal to the spiritual, but also their essential relationship to one another, this doesn't just have implications for how we organize our politics. It also has implications for how we organize our families, for how we organize our communities. Strict understanding of integralism that is purely thinking about law and politics is not going to see a community of friends who are trying to share life together as integralism per se. True. But it is inspired by the notion that our entire lives should be organized around the truth of the church, the truth of Jesus Christ, our relationship with him, the fact that he is the king of not just the universe in some sort of cosmological sense, but the king of our societies, that all order and authority emerges from him. And so even if we are not capturing the United States government and installing a Catholic monarch, we can be organizing integrally Catholic communities in our neighborhoods, in our parishes, in a smaller sense, but in a very true sense, in our families, both as nuclear families, but even more importantly, as extended families. That's one of the big things I get at in the book. And this is how you could read the book as being kind of pseudo-integralist, not in that I am actively, describing or advocating for the overthrow of American-style liberalism, but in that I am advocating for an integrated, integral view of Catholic living that includes essentially a corporate or communal aspect, and that includes authority, that includes a missionary aspect, that includes a full understanding of what it means to be a Christian. Again, not just as an individual, but as a Christian family, a Christian friendship, a Christian community. And so I think the book can participate in that discourse in that way.
This is why I really love Rod Dreher's book, The Benedict Option, because when we talk about ordering our entire lives to God's service, politics is actually a very small part of our lives, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very important part of our lives, but outside of voting every 4 years or every 2 years, you know, we don't actually get a lot of say in what the government does. Mm-hmm. So again, one of the reasons I really like Dreher's thinking is because he emphasizes that, you know, we just talk about politics way too much. We have to start doing the hard work of building these institutions. And you make many of the same points in the Prodigal Church.
Yeah. I think that you know, the book can be kind of in constructive conversation with Rod's work on all of this. I think almost like the seamless garment has become a brand. I think the Benedict Option is a brand, and I think that the concept is in some ways more interesting than the brand, similar to the seamless garment. But the concept of understanding that the situation spiritually and socially is more dire than it might appear at first glance, in terms of the, well, I was going to say in terms of the stability of the social order, but that's, you know, it's catching up.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I wrote something a few years ago about, it was in the aftermath of the Planned Parenthood videos about the selling of the fetal remains. And at the same time this was happening, I had lunch with friends at a modest but quite lovely little restaurant on the Beaver River just outside Pittsburgh. And it was, the grass was green and people were having a great time. This was before, long before the coronavirus.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess it was outdoors, so that would have been okay. But if you were sitting at that moment right then, and you're having an inexpensive but healthy and tasty meal in this beautiful environment, beautiful built environment and beautiful natural environment, it's hard to imagine. It's hard, the idea that the Christian has today, that certainly the Orthodox Christian has today, that our society is not in good shape, and that lots of people are now beginning to realize as well, seemed kind of ridiculous, because we do live very comfortably. We live, there's so much about the way we live is, I guess, if we can jump into Ross Douthat's lane and decadent, live in a way that, where our prosperity allows us to cover over a lot of the rot. And yet, at the same time that I was having that lunch, I'm also thinking about the fact that millions, if not billions of dollars, billions of dollars goes into the abortion industry in this country. Lots of it government money, which doesn't necessarily make it different in kind, but it suggests a complete corporate and state involvement in this industry of the destruction of human life. And it's a strange thing to realize that there is a sense in which not only does this rot coexist with our prosperity and comfort, but there is a sense in which our prosperity and comfort in some sense depends on it, because we would have to be, as the economists would tell us, we would have to be paying for all of those lives. We might not be able to have the society we have right now. It might be a little bit less comfortable. It might be a little bit less orderly. More children, more support needed for those who cannot, or an economy that is ordered such that maybe the per capita GDP isn't as high, but it supports more people at a baseline level. I mean, we're talking about a truly seamless garment country is one where there's a lot more children, but probably a very different way of thinking, not probably, certainly a very different way of thinking about how we order a society that makes that possible. That possible, so that we don't feel like we have to destroy human lives to make the balance sheet work out.
Yeah, I was just having this argument with another prominent Catholic journalist, and who was of the traditional mindset, rightly so in many senses, but was saying, you know, women need to just quit their jobs and go home and raise the kids, take care of the house, and men need to step it up and start supporting their families. And I was, and I said to him, where are they going to get the money to have all these kids? That's the huge, yep. That's the, you know, the it's, and we, you've seen this. I know, I'm sure that you have that, you know, that our economy and our society literally rewards you for not having any children with disposable income, and other, whereas, you know, traditional societies reward you for having children. That's it. It's exactly the opposite. And, you know, again, we can theorize all that we like. But if we're not giving people the means to have children, to have families, to have stable communities outside, you know, urban sprawl, then we're not going to get it. We're not going to have the traditional society that we want. There has to be that economic element.
Yeah, and that goes to what we were saying before about there being an essential material base to these things. It's not the only thing. It's not even the most important thing. And certainly when you have a culture that does not reward traditional family, or that does not reward the sacrifices needed to have a single breadwinner and mom stay at home, that has an impact as well. But it's not only that. I think that's where we can become blinded because we're so afraid of becoming leftists that it's only a question of culture. Elizabeth Warren's not wrong, at least pre-presidential campaign Elizabeth Warren, center-right Elizabeth Warren of the two-income trap is not wrong that the economy becomes structured whenever you have, when two incomes becomes the norm, the economy becomes structured around that precise, and it actually quite intentionally makes it difficult to do anything else because you're trying to extract as much possible labor and excess profits out of as many people as you can. And that includes moms. And then the costs of childcare then just continue to make it more and more, impossible to get out of the, that's why she called it a trap. Mm-hmm. The Quattrocentesimo Anno talks about mothers, the duty of mom to be raising the family at home. But it's not so much a question of a duty as it is a question of a right. She has the right to this, and if that is being denied to her by the organization of the economy, by the organization of our society, then that is a grave injustice. And I forget the exact language, but he uses extremely powerful language to describe the extent to which this isn't a justice and the speed with which it needs to be rectified. Of course, we've only made it worse and worse and worse ever since. To the extent it's possible, yes, I do think that that's certainly the ideal, but that is the having, dad working and so on. But we cannot ignore the extent to which we have organized our economy to make that as difficult as possible.
I wish that we had covered even a quarter of this book. it is so good, and we should just like do a podcast where you just read the book. We can publish it as an audiobook. We'll serialize it. Because this really, I mean, this conversation fascinates me. Not my contributions. That sounded really vain. These topics fascinate me, and this book was incredible, and I've really enjoyed this discussion. And unfortunately, I think we have to wrap it up. We're hitting our upper time limit. But I hope that you'll come back on sometime.
Yes. Yes, absolutely, Michael.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Brandon. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
And thank you all for tuning in. It's been a real pleasure. And until next week, I am your host, Michael Warren Davis, and this is The Crisis Point. Thank you all so much, and God bless you.